My heart has no words. My eyes have no tears left. Mind had done gone crazy. Went off and married my fears. Now I'm standing here with nothing left to tell you. I'm standing here with nothing to prove. I got nothing.
All right, welcome back to Mormon Expression Voices. I will be your host tonight, Greg Rockwell. I've got with me a fantastic guest. I'm very excited to talk to him tonight. Michael Ferguson is a bioengineering PhD student at the University of Utah, and I am proud to call him my friend. And Michael, welcome to Mormon Expression Voices.
Thanks for having me on.
All right. Well, why don't we get started at the beginning? Tell us a little bit about your family and your beginnings in Mormonism and childhood and that sort of thing.
Sure. Well, I started in a very typical Mormon home, I would say, where we went to church every week. Both my parents had callings at the ward and stake levels. Very strict about all of the normal rules. I remember specifically when my brother went on his mission and my family made, you know, a collective promise to never watch a rated R movie again. And I grew up in the DC suburbs. And so the ward was, you know, definitely a place where you felt a sense of refuge from the day-to-day living out in the world. Going to school all throughout grade school was one of the just handful of LDS kids at the school. And so seminary, mutual activities during the week were always just important connecting points. Eagle Scout, went to BYU, really almost boringly typical storyline in that sense. So I was the youngest of three kids, and we were pretty spaced apart. My sister is 15 years older than I am, and I've got a brother that's 10 years older than I am. So my mom definitely is on the conservative side. Both of my parents are converts. My mom grew up Roman Catholic and was very, very devout in her upbringing in Catholicism, taught catechism, washed altar cloths, the whole nine yards, really. My dad's upbringing was a Protestant upbringing. He grew up in the Southern Baptist tradition, going to Bible school. Their conversion stories are pretty interesting, I think. My dad joined the church when he was 14 years old, but the missionaries for the LDS church were visiting his father. I think that they had just, you know, cold contacted him on a door approach and were let in. And my dad was waiting in the other room, kind of listening in on the story of Joseph Smith and the first vision, and just the correspondence between him being, you know, my dad at the time hearing the story, being 14 years old and being a seeker, wanting to connect to God, and hearing the story about Joseph Smith as a 14-year-old having this marvelous divine encounter, that it really struck a chord and reached him. And so he got baptized. He was the only member of his family at the time. They got baptized.
He got baptized at 14, and his parents were okay with that. Did he have other, like, good friends who were Mormon or anything that, like, his parents could have had sort of a reference point?
Not as far as I know. I think that they were kind of laissez-faire as far as religion went. My mom's family was quite the opposite. Her parents really strongly came down hard against her. She had some interest in the LDS church in high school because of some friends, and her parents were very strict that Mormonism was a cult, that it was a sure path to hell. And so, I mean, that was the end of that. She herself didn't really seriously investigate the LDS church until she'd graduated from high school and was out of the house, and her and my father were married already at that point. She had compassion for the missionaries who were outside. They were living in Nova Scotia at the time, and it was in the winter, and the missionaries had actually made an appointment with their next-door neighbor and were standing outside knocking, and no one was answering. And so my mom invited them in to warm up while they were waiting for the neighbor to get there. And then, like good missionaries do, they took advantage of the opportunity to share a message, and you know, the rest is history now.
Was your dad active?
Nope, he was not.
So he had joined the church when he was 14, but didn't sort of stay active all that. Did he serve a mission?
No, he did not.
Oh, okay. And was he excited to think that the sort of the faith of his teens there was coming back in with your mom?
That's a good question. I'm not particularly sure about that. I know that they did end up going to BYU and thinking that they were going to settle in Utah for the duration of their lives and live on the Wasatch Front, raising their family. And then a job opportunity is what initially led my dad to Washington, D.C. And their expectation was only to be out in the D.C. area for maybe 3 to 5 years. And then, again, just one of those twists of life that ended up staying out there for 30-plus years and are still there now. Yep.
Yeah. And okay. So I'm always interested in family dynamics as this relates, because that enthusiasm that we have, you know, for people that are joining the church and kind of, you know, we're so excited for them, even though there's turbulence in their family and we want to be supportive and everything. So you have all of your grandparents are not members of the church.
So interesting story on that. Like I mentioned that my mom's parents were very, very dismissive and very belligerent, actually, about her decision to join the church. They ended up in time taking the discussions themselves and becoming members of the LDS Church, as did a few of my mom's sisters. Likewise, on my dad's side of the family, his stepmother and siblings ended up getting baptized into the LDS Church. His dad was a holdout, never did get baptized before he passed away. But so that's 3 out of 4 grandparents that ended up converting.
So your parents really pulled everybody in to the church to some degree.
They did, yeah, for better or for worse.
Yeah, with the aunts and uncles that didn't, is there tension there, or is your family pretty united in a family way, or is there religious tension where people decided not to sort of join the rush?
Yeah, I think that for the most part, everybody is pretty easygoing as far as being satisfied with a common belief in Jesus Christ and that being an acceptable common denominator. I went to a high school that was quite a bit away from my hometown. It was a magnet high school that I had to either bus or drive into. It was almost an hour each way just to get to school. There were 2 other guys in my ward that went to the school as well. But aside from that, we were pretty isolated. So it created this interesting divide. I mean, I had mentioned before that the ward was an important place and the mutual activities and, you know, different youth events were an important connecting point. And part of the reason for that was because I wasn't going to school with anybody else from the ward, that I was, you know, busting out going to a magnet school. It was a science and technology school. And so lots of emphasis on critical thinking, I think probably a little bit more than your typical high school experience. It was a school that really tried to bring in diverse sets of perspectives. I mean, I remember having lots of days where federal judges would come in and would describe their decisions on different cases and the rationale there, and ethics days where we would, you know, at the high school level, be exposed to different sides of debates like the abortion or the stem cell debates. And so it was a really intellectually engaging atmosphere. I think probably a little bit unusual for what is typical at the high school age. And that certainly was a piece in the way that I thought about the world. From there, it was interesting that, you know, not really associating with high school peers who were LDS and many of whom were, you know, gunning for Ivy schools or for other competitive programs, that I just had a very singular focus that I was going to go to BYU. That was the Lord's University. That was the place where I was really going to take the next step up in my path of an unfolding Mormon life. And so even though, you know, I was growing up outside of Utah in an environment where, like I said, there was probably a lot of critical methodology that I was being exposed to, that even still that Mormon theme, that Mormon trajectory, kind of that Mormon blueprint for life was completely formative on my decision making.
And how would you have described your testimony as it was forming and your inner spiritual life there?
For me, the principle of charity, you know, with the very particular meaning as it's assigned within an LDS context, always resonated with me. I remember, you know, going to an Especially for Youth summer camp, and I remember, going through the process that was prescribed of studying the scripture until you feel the spirit, and then kneeling down and asking whatever question of testimony you had. And I remember specifically asking about God's love, that was what I wanted to know and understand, and have a connection to, was God's love. And I think that the rest of what we would consider, you know, personal testimony really grew out of that principle of just the centrality of God's love in the gospel and in the restoration.
Okay. You wanted to go to BYU and you felt like, okay, you know, there's all these options, but I want to go to...
Definitely. They're just, I mean, it wasn't even a consideration to go to another school. Yeah.
There's a lot of schools back east to consider, you know?
I know. And it's the funniest thing. In retrospect, too, I wonder why didn't like a guidance counselor even say, hey, have you thought of applying someplace else besides BYU?
Okay, so you headed up to BYU directly after high school graduation?
I did, yep.
How was that?
It was good. So I started BYU when I was 17, so I was in a little bit of a strange time position where I did 2 years at the university. And so my first year, my freshman year was, I mean, it was amazing. It really was kind of your idyllic freshman year at Brigham Young University. Just great friends, just had tons of the silly, innocent fun that's so typical of, you know, of BYU students. My second year was a real beast because, I was 18 going on 19. And so I wasn't a freshman. I couldn't really just fit into that same social dynamic that I had my first year at BYU.
Right. All your friends were gone.
Yeah. And that's the thing is that, but then all the guys who I was with in my first year were on their missions, and everyone else was a return missionary. And so it was this real strange limbo year where I really never felt like I fit in anywhere. That year was definitely a year of a lot of solitude, which, you know, allowed for a lot of introspection. It was the year, I would say that it's the year that I really first became sure that something was different developmentally about my sexuality than, you know, just your run-of-the-mill vanilla straight person. But there, again, wasn't really anyone to talk about it with. That year, I was very preoccupied, I do remember, with the question of gender. And, you know, this might have been triggered by feeling like every gender role for a male at BYU was outside of my reach. You know, whether it was, again, that dichotomy of being a freshman, your first year at the university, preparing for your mission and the big mystery of it all versus being a return missionary, being in the place where you're dating, looking for an eternal companion. And so, you know, part of the real distress that I felt about gender that year might have been triggered by the fact that I didn't feel like I was in any clear, that there was any clear gender role for a male at BYU that I could fit into.
And so how did that, where did your mind start to go, or where did that start to lead in your experience?
Well, at first it did not go directly to the questions of sexuality. I mean, at first it really did go to the questions of what does it mean to be a man? What does it mean that women primarily nurture when I felt like I had this really strong desire to love people, and to serve people and to give and be generous. There was a lot of confusion in my mind between gender examples from general authorities and in general conference, where I felt like the personae that I observed in male priesthood leadership were feminized compared to what I felt was actually accepted and embraced and celebrated as male and masculine identity. The type of sensitivity and of in-tuneness with emotionality that's encouraged and well encouraged. I mean, I'm glad that it's encouraged in roles of priesthood leadership and, you know, from the pulpit and talks that are given in general conference. I felt like the emphasis, I mean, especially you go to priesthood session and so many of the talks are based on, you know, to their credit, they're based on being gentle to your spouse and being kind to your children and all of these characteristics that, again, when I felt like I was longing to connect to a concrete sense of masculinity, it was interesting that turning to priesthood and church and gospel felt almost like a deflection, almost like a barrier from being able to connect to just this raw masculine sense that I was craving.
So you're looking for, you're really pondering that and pondering sort of pondering this concept of gender and gender roles, how you fit into it. You have discovered that there is a space where you legitimately and righteously, you are doing everything right, but you do not have a place that you fit in the culture that you're living in.
That's correct. And it was a legitimate preoccupation for me that year. So as a little interesting side note, it turned out that my last semester at BYU, I was roommates in an apartment of return missionaries, and that my roommate, I had the hugest man crush on him. And that was where I feel like I really started thinking, oh crap, this is something that has a life of its own that I don't feel like I can even begin to handle. And so I remember that was where the pre-verbal conflict, if you will, with sexuality really reached the surface and got to a boiling point. And I just remember feeling so in love, I guess, with my roommate, and yet not knowing why, but feeling like that was just so incompatible with any real option that I had, that I mean, I remember just days running and sobbing and going, like, running up to the Provo Temple and trying to find some type of peace at the grounds of the temple. So anyways, that's when I would say that it started becoming turbulent, you know, where it moved from preoccupation to distress. That was the same semester, though, that I did get my mission call. I was called to go to Arizona, went to the Tempe mission, and in the MTC, I remember that I learned very early in my mission that these types of questions about gender and about gender normativity are just not the types of questions that other 19-year-old guys want to talk about.
No. Probably not even that other 19-year-old guys are even equipped. It's not even a question of desiring to talk about. They've in a sort of a normal Mormon setting, I would say that they are not equipped to even really think about them in any kind of nuanced way. And I don't mean to be dismissive. Maybe I do mean to be a little dismissive, but I mean that's just kind of the reality of the culture that we grew up in, isn't it? I mean.
Sure. Gender's not really an explorative discussion point.
Yeah, we're taught to fit into roles, not to craft our own roles or to push with them very much. I think that that's very normal in sort of the Mormon experience as a whole, not just in gender roles. So you had this conflict that you didn't. Did you know how to voice it to yourself before you left on your mission, or did that or did that sort of just remain in kind of a primal?
It was mostly nonverbal. I did go to one fireside before our mission where Fred and Marilyn Mattis, who have been, they've been amazing individuals and increasing awareness and increasing sensitivity to the way that the LDS Church responds and the LDS culture responds to its members who are attracted to the same gender. But they were giving a fireside and they introduced the phrase, you know, SSA, same-sex attraction. And so I remember that I started thinking in terms of SSA, but again, at this point, it was still, when I did go there, it was still very much contained to internal monologue as opposed to any type of discussion with someone else.
Can you give us a 2-minute talk on why the Mattises are concerned about this issue of same-sex attraction?
Sure. So back in 2000, when California was trying to pass Proposition 22, which was sort of
the original Prop 8.
Previous incarnation of Prop 8. Yeah, exactly. That their son, Stuart Mattis, took his lives on the steps of a stake center in Palo Alto and made a statement basically, I'm grossly truncating it, but a statement that we're here, we're hurting, we're your brothers and sisters, we're your children, we're not the other that you think you're directing all this political outrage toward.
And so his parents have been and continue to be involved in sort of the issue of same-sex attraction in the church?
They have. They co-authored a book with Ty Mansfield that was published by Deseret Book. The title of it is In Quiet Desperation. And they also, for a number of years, would have monthly firesides in Utah County that they would host. And I know that they had, different priesthood leaders. I don't remember exactly. I'm pretty sure there were some general authorities who did come and speak at some of these firesides, but also Mormon musical personalities would come and speak and just give messages of encouragement and support and of love.
And you went to that fireside while you were at BYU before your mission?
No, actually. So this was before they were doing what became sort of like institutionalized as the Mattis firesides. The Mattises did just some smaller speaking engagements. My roommate my freshman year was in the music, dance, theater program. And because is such, a disproportionately high percentage of men in the MDT program who are gay, they had, focused on, I guess the guys in the MDT program is like a high-risk group who need to hear this message. And since he was in that program, he invited me to come to the fireside, and that was my first exposure to that.
To think about a group that is being regarded as high risk, I don't even know where to sort of go with that. Okay, so that was your freshman year, and that wasn't a point where you were really thinking about that in yourself, or were you thinking about that in yourself?
I was very schizophrenic about it. Like I would be cognizant of my emotions, and then in turn I would have like a verbalized internal monologue about other people who I thought were gay, but never the two did meet.
So I don't want to get into a conversation about all the things, the stereotypical, like, did this happen to you? Because I'm tired of that conversation, and I feel like we need to move away from that as a culture and just deal with healthy individuals. But tell me about, what was your experience with girls? I mean, did you date in high school girls?
I did not. I mean, I went to the dances, like homecoming and prom, and took dates to those dances, but I never had a girlfriend. Kind of the family culture that I grew up in, or at least for me, the family culture that my parents created for me, I should say, was that exclusive dating was something that was explicitly for after marriage. And so made my high school experience easier. I didn't have to explain too much away since the standard was to wait as it was.
Your parents, let's clarify that. Or make sure that we're clear. Your parents said exclusive dating was for post-marriage?
Post-mission.
So you didn't really date. Would you describe your own sort of intersexual development as being relatively, that you had questions about it?
It was, yes, but very much, I mean, very much in a repressed way, where I think that there were like early recognitions that something was different. I remember, for example, one time, I don't even remember why I came in contact with this, but I came in contact with an Allen Ginsberg poem, who he's a gay poet in high school. And I remember reading it and just feeling this charge. And it wasn't an erotic, it wasn't a pornographic poem, but there were things like that, that were these connecting moments that I remember being scared in that moment, like, oh crap, please, no, this can't be, don't let this happen. And then experiencing the panic and then just shutting it down, putting it on the shelf and moving on.
So you get called to beautiful Tempe, Arizona. And so MTC mission, you're not out to yourself.
I'm not.
Right?
I'm not. No. And there were a couple of times on my mission that I was inclined to bring up that conversation topic with a mission president during a mission president's interview. And I think that my logic at the time was that, you know what, if I bring this up, it only caused him worry. That would be unnecessary because he already has so much to worry about bringing people into the church. And so I don't want to be one more thing that he has to worry about as a distraction.
And you didn't have anything to confess.
And I didn't.
You didn't have any, you hadn't done anything.
I had that magical. That's correct.
The part of the fun of being Mormon is that everything revolves around what we do. Right?
Exactly.
Acts are a big deal. And so if you haven't done anything, then what's there to talk about?
There you go.
So you're thinking about, so how did you feel about your companions? Did you have any companions that you sort of felt yourself sort of having a crush on?
Oh yeah, there was one that I had a big crush on. But most of them, I think that it was just pretty
just
hanging out with a buddy and wearing shirts and taking scriptures out on the street.
And I think that this is an interesting thing. So let's pause for a moment and say, so me, I'm a sort of a legitimately heterosexual guy. And somehow in my life, I've been able to interact with a variety of women without having it become some hypersexualized thing, you know? And I don't know that, I think that one of those stereotypes that has somehow pervaded our culture is that on the other side, on the homosexual side,
sure,
that there's some rabid sexuality that's just like every man that you see, you're just like, oh, you know,
it's like irresistibly drawn to,
just this animalistic drive or whatever, you know. And really, no, I have to presume that in most of your human dealings with members of a gender to which you are attracted, you're still sort of like, ha-ha.
Yeah, it's pretty ho-hum.
For some reason, we understand what chemistry is in our heterosexual thinking, but don't really attribute sort of that choosy, that discriminating chemistry aspect to homosexual.
Sure. Yeah. And I think that that's a great observation. It's one of the major sources of fear and misunderstanding.
Why is that, Michael? Why do we do that?
Well, Greg, let me explain the world.
Okay. Well, you're hitting a couple of bumps in the road that you're turning off like a light switch. But it's just a little cognitive dissonance, it sounds
like. It is. And I would, you know, switch themes just a little bit here and say that on my mission was where I really started having, let me think of a good way to describe this. I hate to say the early seeds of apostasy because that makes it sound like, you know, this dark, negative, scary thing.
Yeah, what was happening to your testimony on your mission? What experiences were you having to build that or to not?
I think that here's the way that I would put it, is that it was the liberalization of my testimony on my mission. And that was an absolutely crucial process for the later life growth that I was able to experience. I was in a unique culture in the sense that everyone in Mesa knows who the Mormons are, everyone. And so everyone already has an opinion one way or the other. And so it wasn't so much introducing the church to people as it was responding to people's opinions about the church. There's an especially stark divide between the evangelical non-denominational Christian base in the Mesa area and the LDS population. My experience anyways, and maybe this is not representative because I was a missionary at the time, but my experience was that the non-denominational Christian base is very antagonistic toward the church, like very antagonistic and pulling out, you know, some of those classic...
Come on in, Elder. Let's watch the God Makers
together.
Yeah,
that kind of stuff. Exactly. And so a lot of my mission was defending the Christianity of Mormonism. And let's be honest, that to do that, I had to liberalize some of the scriptures from their interpretations in classic Orthodox Mormonism. Just a case in point to give an illustration, that, you know, we've got the great scripture in 2 Nephi that says that by grace you're saved after all you can do. And, you know, kind of this Orthodox Mormon perspective is that means that you've got to give every last drop of everything in your guts, and then after you do that,
then Jesus will step in.
Yeah. And I mean, I remember preaching it with the exact inverted interpretation, saying that even if you did that, even if you gave every drop that you had, that it still wouldn't be enough, and that no matter what it is, that it's grace that saves you. Kind of making grace the catch-all as opposed to the earned salvation.
Sure. Well, I mean, and that viewpoint has started to be popularized in the church. I usually think of largely through Stephen Robinson and through his book Believing Christ. Did you read Believing Christ?
I did. Yep. And that was definitely something that informed a more liberal perspective.
Gave you a way to sort of go in a he has an agenda to become evangelical friendly.
Sure.
Right? Okay, that makes sense.
Yes, I was definitely moving along those lines in the way that I was interpreting scripture and the way that I was developing, you know, this intersection of faith and worldview.
And was the online conversation, I guess I don't have a real handle on kind of your age as it relates to sort of the age of the internet. Was the online conversation starting to inform the topics that were being brought up by your friendly neighborhood evangelicals?
Not so much. I think so. I started my mission in 2001 to 2003, and I think that it was like right before the real search engine explosion where everybody would Google anything.
Interesting. Okay. Yeah. Okay. So you started to sort of identify the ways to make Mormonism more traditional Christian friendly.
Yeah. More inclusive. I would say more universalistic.
Okay. All right, and so how did that feel?
Oh, it felt great, and at no point in that process did I feel like I was being manipulative or deceitful in the presentation. If anything, I felt like I was continually accessing a truer and truer understanding.
You know, it's funny, that brings up something that I guess I realized a while ago that probably was a bit of a, I don't know if problem is the right word, but when you explain your version of Mormonism and the doctrines that you believe, you don't generally think this is my opinion. You think, well, this is what the doctrines are. And if somebody disagreed with me on this, especially when you're maybe trying to go that more inclusive route, you say to yourself, if somebody disagreed with me on this, it's just because they don't understand, they're not thinking about it in the right way, which is highly condescending. I mean, right?
Yeah.
But I sometimes specialize in that to my chagrin. So, did you feel that way? Did you, you knew that not all the missionaries would be giving that same message. Did you think, well, if they just understood a little better, that this is what they would teach?
Oh, for sure. For sure. And I think that I did try. I mean, I got the chance to train a couple missionaries who, just entered the mission field. And I think that I tried anyway to distill some of that perspective.
Sort of move them in the, let's talk about the constructive way to go about teaching the scriptures.
Sure. Like I remember, for example, we were, Spanish speaking missionary in Arizona. It's the bulk of the investigators that we had were from Mexico. Lots of them had the Virgin of Guadalupe, which is sort of the Mexicans. It's not a national symbol per se, but it's pretty darn close to being a national symbol, of the Virgin Mary. But anyway, I remember toward the end of my mission teaching a family that had, an icon of the Virgin hanging up in the front room, and my companion, who was my junior companion, saying that they needed to take that down before we would let them be baptized. And gosh, maybe I'm revising my memory here, but I seem to remember being, expansive enough in my thinking that I said that if that was the way that they connected to God, that that was a good thing for them to have, if it helped them to connect to Christ and to, I totally might be making that up. Like in retrospect, I'm like, but we'll go with that. Let's put that on the record. Yeah. If anything, it was at least a part of my thinking. I do remember that. And anyways,
your testimony was being liberalized. Was it being weakened?
No, because if anything, I would say that that liberalization also included a liberalization of what I identified as the Spirit. And so I remember specifically at the time Gordon Hinckley was a prophet, I remember specifically, praying for one of these testimonies that I heard other people say with such conviction that they had, a very discreet, concrete experience where the Spirit gave them a manifestation of the prophet's calling, and thinking, gosh, I mean, I believe, but I didn't have that type of discreet encounter with the numinous. And so I remember praying for that same type of testimony seeking prayer, applying it to Joseph Smith's calling. And I remember in both of those instances, being on my knees, being in this contemplative prayerful state, and then kind of after being in that space long enough, saying to myself, well, I guess I feel pretty peaceful. And, being like, yeah, that's the Spirit. Yeah, we'll go with that.
I know that feeling. okay. And so was that good enough, kind of, when you said, well, I guess that's the
Spirit? It really was. It really was at the time. At the time, it really didn't seem like it was a cop-out. It was like, oh, God is so ubiquitous that he was already here anyway. And so, yeah, I feel good and peaceful about this.
Was there any sort of further theological sort of emergence of a more liberal or a more nuanced self on your mission? Or does that pretty well describe it?
The other major take home from my mission was I remember really wrestling with the most basic scripture in Doctrine and Covenants, where it says, the one
true
and living church with which I am well pleased. Yeah. And I remember thinking, you know what, when I get home from my mission, I'm going to look up the original text and see if there was a comma. There had to have been a comma, misplaced to separate, the clause that the church is true and living, comma, with which I'm well pleased. Like in my mind, I had it to where the Lord had to be saying that it's that there's many true and living churches, but of the many true and living churches, this is the one with which he's well pleased right now. Yeah.
Interesting. What did you find when you went home and looked at that scripture?
Oh, well, you know what? There were such bigger fires that that I don't think that one ended up.
That one retreated. Okay. Let's get to those bigger fish to fry. What happened?
Sure. So this is, I think, to me, this is kind of interesting that I I had dreams on my mission that were really vivid that, you know, as a missionary, I chalked them up to being visionary types of dreams. And one of them was about, it was me studying about the translation process of the Book of Mormon. Wow. And I felt really strongly like God was giving me a message, a directed personal revelation to study the translation of the Book of Mormon. And so that was one of the places that I went in my studies of Mormonism when I got home from my mission. And here's the thing that I would want to emphasize is that in trying to piece together as precise of a view of early Mormon history as I could, it was totally driven by my believingness, you know, by the premise that if I could just learn enough details, I would see the contours of the Lord's hand in the founding of the church so clearly that right. I would see the Lord.
Right. That is, you start to move into the details, the puzzle pieces fit together. Even if at the beginning you don't really see how, as you move into the details, it will all, the truth will circumscribe into one great whole, right?
I've heard that phrase before. And so I read from faith-based literature. I mean, I was reading, for example, books like Opening the Windows of Heaven, By the Hand of Mormon, when Terrell Givens published that. Of course, you know, Richard Bushman's Rough Stone Rolling. So I took a church history class where the professor had a terrific talent for evoking emotional responses and telling vignettes about church history that were, I mean, very lovely and very captivating.
Were you back at BYU at this point?
At BYU, yep, this is BYU. But I remember there was one time when a student raised her hand and asked the professor, why is it that Brigham Young and Emma Smith never got along? And this was the response, was that, well, in DNC Section 25, Emma had received the instruction to put together a hymn book, and Brigham Young went behind her back and collected some hymns, and she never forgave him for stepping in on her revealed calling. And I was like, what? Where did that even come from? That, I mean, there was no mention of polygamy. There was no mention of, you know, the Starting of the Relief Society and Emma's counselors who were plural wives of Joseph. There was just,
and were you aware of those things at that time?
I was aware of the polygamy conflict between Emma and Brigham. Not in any, you know, significant detail, but I mean, I at least knew that was substantially more important than if there was any type of hymn book tension between the two of them.
That was a milk strippings answer if ever there was one.
Yeah. No, really, really. Yeah. And so, I mean, it was this realization that, whoa, I need to check my sources and not take at face value how church history is being portrayed by people who are interested in me having, you know, this kind of warm, affirming response when I'm learning about the early history of the church.
So was that kind of an epiphany of skepticism at that moment?
Oh, for sure. Yeah, that's a great way to describe it.
Like, you had a crystallized moment where all of a sudden your skeptic sweat turned on.
Right, and where I had a very clear reason for it to be on.
Wow, okay. Well, God bless that teacher.
I know, exactly.
Okay,
and Lord, so, mysterious ways.
You started to look with a little less faithfulness, a little more. How do you describe that?
That's a great question. And I think that I really struggled to frame what it was that I was looking for at that point. I remember that I came across the Book of Breathings, the alternate translation for the Pearl Grip Rites of the Book of Abraham. And that was, I mean,
the alternate.
The translation of the, you know, Kirtland Egyptian papers. And that was really the one that was just a huge sledgehammer for me. I mean, that one was just huge. And I remember specifically talking, again, you know, behind closed doors, one-on-one with religion faculty at BYU about this. And I mean, feeling like I kind of had to look both ways and speak in a whispery voice because I didn't want to
kill anybody else's
rock
faith.
Anybody's boat. Yeah, yeah. I mean, it was just so shocking to me. And I remember this particular professor who I'm thinking of right now, gosh, just as a side note, even still, like, I feel like I have to protect their identities. Like, it's, you know, some type of scandal that they'll get in trouble for.
Okay.
Anyway.
I understand that feeling.
But anyway, they were talking to me about a painting of a sailboat that they had on their wall in their office. And they said, now I could tell you this great story about this sailboat and about the sailor who was on it and his life and his times. He said, and it doesn't matter if it's true or not. If you got something out of it, that's what matters. And I just remember thinking, oh, no, 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 no. That's not okay.
You did not just okay. Go there.
Yeah, yeah.
Wow.
And so I feel like that was my first real kind of glimpse behind the curtain, so to speak, and my first real awareness that some of the myth makers don't buy the myth.
Yeah. Wow. Okay. And so we're at an interesting place. How long had you been home from your mission?
By this point, I had probably been home for about 2.5 years.
Wow. Okay. And you're clearly not married at that point.
And I'm not married. Nope. I am going to therapy to try and get straight.
Do you just to reparative therapy?
Yep. Reparative therapy.
So let's pick up the other end of that stick
okay.
and go back. So what you came home and you became more cognitively aware that your chemistry/wiring wasn't firing in the way that you expected it to.
Yeah, that's correct. So I started dating this girl who she was terrific. She was smart, funny, cute, well put together. She herself, she was a medical student up at the University of Utah. So, I mean, we were commuting back and forth between Provo and Salt Lake to date. And it got to a point where I realized that I wasn't going to get rid of the feelings that I was having toward men. And so I was really prayerful about it, really contemplative about it. And I decided, you know what, I'm going to sit her down and I'm just going to tell her what the situation is. And if she wants to keep dating, then we'll keep dating. And if that's more than she can take on, then, you know, we'll very respectfully end the relationship.
Can I ask, okay, I can edit this out, but can I ask a couple of questions? I mean, were you dating this girl?
Were we still kissing?
Yeah, were you making out with her? Actually, that was the question I was going to ask.
Yeah, that's funny. We were, and then...
You get to a certain point, and it's not really you making the moves necessarily anymore. It's, you know, she's going to make the moves.
Yeah. Yeah, so... in our relationship, I had pulled out an old study manual from a Book of Mormon course that had cited Spencer W. Kimball speaking at a state conference in Australia where he is quoted as saying that, you know, the kiss of the soul should be reserved for marriage. And so I read this to her and, you know, just looked at her and said, so what do you think about that? And she's just like blinking in disbelief that this is happening. Like,
who has this conversation?
What the heck? Yeah, exactly. Yeah. and being really serious that, you know, if we want this relationship to succeed, then we need to have the spirit in it. And the best way to ensure the spirit is to follow the prophet, you know? And so, I mean, it was sure made a lot of logical sense when
I love you, Mike. That's fantastic. Okay. All right. So was she okay with that? Or she was like, well, why don't we just try making out a little bit and just see how you feel about
she
it then?
She was weirded out by it, but like went along with it.
Okay.
But I mean, it wasn't too long after that event happened that, you know, I took her to the temple one night, read some scriptures about Paul's thorn in the flesh, about, Nephi's self-loathing, that he's such a wretched man, and said that all of us have something that we wrestle with, and this is mine, that, you know, I have SSA, I have same-sex attraction, but...
You had identified it then, by then. At some point in between coming home from your mission, or sometime on your mission, or whatever, you just said, okay, this is what it is.
Well, and this particular relationship is what catalyzed that, because I was like, gosh, there's no other way to dice out what this is other than to call the spade a spade.
Yeah, at some point your friends are going, dude, your girlfriend is super hot, and you're thinking, oh, is she? Really?
Yeah. Well, and that was one thing too. I mean, so in retrospect, my mom actually just this past year has said to me, you know, I always wondered why you would ask us if your girlfriends were cute.
Interesting. That is a really interesting observation from good old mom. Okay, so you had the chat with, you explained Paul's thorn in the flesh.
Right.
And second, and the Psalm of Nephi.
Yeah, and she was totally on board. And she was like, well, and this was, okay, so parenthetically, let me just say that it is so annoying when you do come out to someone and they say, and they, you know, tell you that they love you the same, they always will. And then, like, you know, as they're about to walk away, they're like, I always knew. And you're like, shut up. But so this conversation is the exact opposite, though, where, you know, I told her this and she said, well, if you're telling me this, then it makes me think that there are a lot more people with this challenge than I thought, because I never would have suspected that this was.
Oh, okay. I like her better now again.
I know.
She was like that. Okay.
She can stay.
Okay.
Yeah.
She can stay in the good circle. The circle of trust. Okay. And so you said, okay. And so she says, wow, that's kind of an eye opener. And what'd you guys decide?
And so we said, we're going to keep dating.
She's like, I'm going to cure you.
I don't think she was quite that cavalier about it, but I think that we just both underestimated how big that issue is.
At the point that you sort of have explained that to your girlfriend, how does that then move into therapy?
Sure. So, as my bishop at the time said, well, all we got to do is, you know, turn down the knob on men and turn up the knob on women. And I was like, oh, that's it. Let's do it.
So, Michael, have you ever heard of a magazine called Playboy? Because I think now's the right time to introduce you to that.
No, no kidding. Therapeutic pornography. That'll be the day.
How did he recommend to turn up the volume knob on women? I'm curious. How do you turn up the volume knob on women?
Well, it always sort of just hovered as this abstract metaphor that, you know, there was never really a prescription for how one does that. I mean, like I said, I did start going to reparative therapy counseling at the BYU Counseling Center.
I want to point out that the rest of the men in the church are being asked to turn down the volume knob on women constantly. What does a reparative therapist want you to do?
So, in that context, excuse me, there are a lot of questions about wounds that I may have obtained from other males in my life growing up.
Conversation with your, or the relationship with your dad.
Yeah, kind of that whole vein of thought. And I just didn't feel like it was helping a ton. I didn't feel like it was approaching its purported aims. I didn't feel like the model that was being asserted was really correspondent with my life. And so I didn't stay too consistent with it.
Because it's trying to go in and figure out the gear or cog out of place, and it's trying to find that magic key place to say, oh, we found the little thing.
Sure. And more than that, I mean, it really is based on this assumption that there is a one-size-fits-all cause of homoeroticism.
None of those people have ever read Alfred Kinsey, huh?
I don't know. It's interesting. I since have had follow-up conversation with my reparative therapist from BYU. And I mean, it sounds like there is a lot more empiricism that is informing the way that they approach this issue down there.
Boy, if there's anything that I've learned to appreciate in the last few years, it's the word empiricism. Thank you for bringing that into this conversation.
No, absolutely. At that point, I doubled down my efforts. So, I mean, I started as an ordinance worker at the Provo Temple, not just a veil worker, mind you, a full-blown ordinance worker. Yeah. And would go in the mornings before classes and officiate. I mean, I was doing everything that I knew how to do. Even though I wasn't going to counseling, I was still meeting with my bishop and maintaining an open conversation with him about the issue. With every one of my bishops at BYU, from that point forward, with every one of my bishops at BYU, I had an open conversation about orientation.
You are a good guy, obeying all the commandments, working in the temple, never had a moment where you made the decision to want this.
Correct.
And how long did you stick with that program?
Okay, well.
and at the same time, you're learning about lovely things like the Book of Breathings. I love this conversation. I love that we don't get to pigeonhole you into just one box of apostasy. You
get, but two.
You get two boxes of pigeonholing. Okay.
Oh gosh. My poor mother.
It makes you so much more interesting, Michael.
So, gosh. My time in the temple was really interesting because I felt like I had taken this step to make a very clear commitment to the Lord. And so I felt like when I was in the temple that I had this communication channel where I was getting messages from the Lord that were like kind of the private gospel that was different from the public gospel that he was allowed to talk about through prophets, et cetera, et cetera. And one of the tenets of the private gospel was transgression, was the subtle commandment to transgress. That there was one day when I was officiating, and in the video depiction of the fall, there's that scene where Eve grabs the fruit, and it's a close-up on her face, and she has this enlightenment moment. And she says, it's better for us to partake of this, that we may know the good from the evil. And, I mean, it is billed as an honorable choice that had to occur in order for her to overcome mortality and really experience the full spectrum of good and evil. And so I really remember feeling like I was getting a message from God that the only way around the city was through the city, so to speak, that the only way out of homosexuality was to go into homosexuality. A second piece of that really was this sense that, wow, you know what? Sex is a way bigger deal to society than it is to God. Well, I just remember sitting outside of the endowment room and looking at the portrait painting of Joseph Smith, and at this point knowing how many dozens of wives he had, and just thinking that man was highly sexually active, and just thinking like if he was like the second only to Christ in the work of salvation on this planet, and he was getting it on, then there is a disconnect between God's accounting and humans' accounting, clearly. So now this is my senior year. I think that I had actually graduated at this point, and I was just in Provo working at the summer, finishing up some research projects in the chemistry department. And there was one Sunday that I had set aside as my own personal fast day. And I was specifically fasting to know about the veracity of the church's truth claims. Mm-hmm. And that Sunday, in Gospel Doctrine, the lesson was on Hiram Page and on
alternative revelations.
And the primacy of revelation from priesthood leadership, and how, here you had Joseph Smith saying, guess what? Heavens are open. Dialogic revelation. Anyone can engage God. If any of you lack wisdom, let him ask directly. God giveth liberally, upbraideth not, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So you have this one line of religious polemic, and then you have someone actually
doing that,
taking that at face value and receiving these revelations, and you have a revelation that says, well, I know that I said revelation was for anybody, but my revelation trumps your revelation, and that's the revelation. And it's just like, oh my gosh, this revelation bidding war that just seemed so transparent. Like, it seemed like such transparent power grabbing.
How many people, I wonder, have cognitive dissonance about that Hiram Page versus Joseph sort of my revelation is bigger than your revelation
it
problem?
It was. And it came on the day that I was fasting specifically about the substance of the truth claims of the church.
Well, isn't this the moment where we say, well, there was your answer. That is the line.
But why was the Spirit putting so much, I don't know, so much cognitive dissonance into the way that I was looking at it? Yeah, so anyway, I really felt like, gosh, maybe that is my answer, that I need to be skeptical about this, because if I'm opening myself up to the influence of the Spirit, I'm fasting, I'm at church, I'm taking the ordinances, and this is where I'm led, as much as I am trying so diligently to follow promptings, maybe that's saying something. And so that is a point where I started reading from literature that was not published by Deseret Book, and where, I mean, I just started seeing so many things fall apart. At this point, I was applying for jobs. I got a job in Boston, and so I moved to Boston kind of in the middle of this faith crisis. And Boston is probably the place where I fought the hardest, both for my testimony and for heteronormativity, for, you know, a lifestyle that by all observations would pass as a heterosexual lifestyle. Got really involved in the singles ward there. Regular meetings with my bishop, was going to addiction recovery groups sponsored by LDS Social Services to overcome the addiction of homosexuality, was going to Exodus International Groups, which is a Christian ex-ministry, was going on retreats. And then in Boston, was very active and very believing. Again, like I mentioned, a big part of it was that peer pressure factor where pressure is maybe not the right word, but just kind of this peer momentum where there are just so many amazing, interesting people doing wonderful, good things in the world. And it's just a very dynamic and attractive group of people. And I got very drawn into the goodness of the ward there. And that was able to sustain me for quite a while. Incidentally, so that was the year 2005 that Richard Bushman had published Rough Stone Rolling. I'm trying to remember when exactly it was that I heard an interview with him where he basically asserted that he thinks that we're asking the wrong questions when we're asking truth questions about the LDS narrative. And this is sort of a sentiment that, several believing scholars have expressed, that, the proper questions are about whether it's good more so than whether it's true. I think that it opens up the territory for a lot of potential pain when you do start conflating questions about goodness and questions of truth, and questions of historicity and authority. I guess that, to unpack a little bit what I mean when I say truth questions, that I'm referring to, both historicity and authority questions, as they're, particular to the LDS set of considerations.
If we say historicity and authority, there's also a cosmological reality component that goes with it as well, right? I mean, there's, does God live on Kolob?
Sure.
Is he an old white guy with a beard?
Sure, sure. And I think that for me that those are a little bit more esoteric in the sense that whether or not, you know, Kolob is a metaphor or a literal planet doesn't impact me so much as the question of whether or not that entity is speaking directly in a revelatory fashion to priesthood leadership. That, you know, the place where the rubber meets the road for me comes back down to the authority questions. And so you're completely right that it does have cosmological implications, but as far as where that translates into some type of pragmatic difference, it hits the authority chord. Yeah. A lot of the reasons why I can't just let Mormonism go completely and walk away from it and pretend like it never happened, you know, are because of questions that I still want answers to. You know, questions like, how did the Book of Mormon come into existence? You know, that like you're saying, that there are these things that have to be accounted for. And I think that it does cut both ways. I will fast forward just a little bit and say that, you know, so Boston, I was in this high point as far as my belief and as far as my activity in Mormonism. And again, a lot of that stemming from this subtle shift in focusing on whether it's good rather than whether it's true. And really, you know, being able to get a little bit more gas mileage out of my faith experience when that was the paradigm that I had. After I was in Boston for a year, moved to New York City, started medical school down there. Medical school just is an all-consuming experience. And anybody who's gone through it or has had a family member or a friend go through it, you know, doesn't need an explanation about how it just completely overtakes your life. And so a lot of these questions became definitely put on the shelf just to try and get through my medical studies. During my second year of medical school, both the faith question and the sexual orientation question were just too demanding of my emotion, of my psychology, of my attention. I ended up taking a leave of absence from medical school and transferred out here to the University of Utah, where I'm working on my PhD in bioengineering. This becomes very complex. And just to distill it down to its most elemental components, I was starting to migrate to an even more skeptical place in terms of my faith, and also a more accepting place with regard to my own personal identity as a gay man. And I started to be very anxious that perhaps the reason for that was because of my environment, was because of my context, rather than, you know, some authentic internal realization that I was having about the nature of the world or the nature of myself. And so I wanted to move to Salt Lake City because I felt like I'd be surrounded by, you know, Mormon influences. I'd be able to have more confidence in the discoveries that I was making, like I said, about the world, about the history of the church, about my own personal interface with my faith. And so that was a driving factor for coming out to Utah. I would say that the major shift for me was about a year and a half ago, where I had gone back to a place of reading from faith-affirming literature. So principally things that were coming from Deseret Book. I purchased a copy of the first volume of the Joseph Smith Papers that had just been released and, you know, was reading Joseph's words directly. And then I just kind of had this, it was just really one of these aha types of moments where in particular I was reading about the social context in upstate New York in the 19th century with regard to magic and with regard to some of the folk traditions of treasure seeking and of divining and of communing with ancient spirits. And it was, I mean, again, it was a subtle shift, but it was just this realization that, you know what? Mormon origin makes so much more sense when viewed as in the context of cultural product, like cultural production of Joseph Smith being an outgrowth of so many religious and cultural factors that surrounded him. And just, again, it was very subtle, but I compare it to kind of what C.S. Lewis says with respect to his belief in God generally, where he says that it's not so much that I see God, but because of God, I can see. And he compares God to the sun and says, you know, we don't know the sun is there because we look directly at it, but because we can see everything else, or because we can see everything else, we therefore deduce that there is a sun. So in parallel with that type of reasoning, I was looking at Mormonism and I was saying, you know what? Yes, I can have several dozen stories that are very suspicious, and I can look at the least likely explanation to explain all of them away, or I can take a step back and look at all of them kind of holistically and say, wow, there really is a much simpler unifying explanation for it.
One of the interesting things that I've noted about sort of apologetics in general, going along with that theme, is that apologetics really relies on not seeing the forest for the trees. And I would say not, and as much as it can, even focusing in on the smallest leaf possible, like let's look in as microscopically as possible and refuse to look at this holistically. It's the antithesis of all truth can be circumscribed into one great whole. You have to look at each individual in its own little tiny box, each individual issue in its own little tiny box, and not regard any of that together, because once you regard it all together, you know, it's just insurmountably problematic.
What's frustrating also with that approach is that my experience generally has been that with an apologetic approach, that there's this double changeo, this like bait and switch that occurs, where then I'm told, well, you need to look at your feelings and at the warm comfort feelings that you get, and that's the forest, like that's the bigger picture, and that I'm the one who's getting lost, who can't, you know, see the forest from the trees when I'm focusing on Joseph Smith's polygamy or the Book of Breathings or Masonic ritual or, you know, any number of problematic issues.
Well, I'll just ask, did you feel warm and fuzzy feelings, or did you feel anxiety and mental anguish?
Well, this is actually a great segue that unifies sort of my personal faith journey with my personal journey for identity that encompasses sexuality. You know, that I think, so people have asked me before, do you think that you would have stopped participating in the church if the church accepted homosexuality? Or, you know, conversely, people ask me, do you think that you'll go back to the LDS church if there's some, you know, official declaration that makes homosexuality an acceptable policy within the church? And for the first question, I honestly do. I have to admit that were it not for being gay, I don't know that I would have had the same level of dissonance, and that I would have been driven to ask the questions. I think that the answers to the questions that I was asking are totally independent of whether I'm a gay man or a straight man. But certainly some of those tensions that propelled me to ask questions in the first place did come to, you know, this dissonance that I had in the feelings of the prescribed life path versus what was going on inside of me.
I completely agree with that, and I want to give you some validation from a heterosexual man that I feel exactly the same way about my own heterosexuality and my inability to make it fit within the proscriptive and repressed Mormon paradigm, and that made me think a lot about it.
So I mean, it's a synergy back and forth where, you know, had it not been for dissonance at the emotional level, then perhaps I could have just retreated into the warm feelings, you know, and kind of let that be the final answer. But when, you know, feelings about what is supposed to be fulfilling versus what actually feels right and real internally are not in parallel with each other, then you don't have that place of emotional comfort to retreat to escape from all of these major factual concerns that are, you know, in the realm of intellect and of mind. One of the things that I did when I made the decision to stop participating in the LDS Church was to figure out, well, if this isn't the true church, then which one is? That, you know, I very much still had that mindset that there has to be such a thing as a true church with a capital T.
That is such a Mormon concept and question,
yeah,
isn't it?
And so I was really driven to find it. And I mean, for a while, the Eastern Orthodox Christian Church, I mean, came pretty darn close to getting me. Pretty darn close. The thing, though, is that, gosh, there really is this dualism to the way that I interact with religion now, in the sense that I don't anymore have the mentality of there being a one true religion or a one true anything, you know, that's like the singular totality of inspiration and revelation and salvation. At the same time, though, I feel like I do value all religion collectively as the best efforts that humans are making to commune with divinity, that the best effort that humans are making, as completely flawed as those efforts are, that it is an outgrowth of this attempt to connect to that which is higher, to connect to divinity, to connect to some transcendent truth that, you know, will imbue meaning into our lives and give us purpose. And I think that that's beautiful. And that's something that I do want. I do want, you know, to feel like my life has meaning. I do want to connect to the, you know, higher order and transcendent truth that exists in the universe. And so even though the way that I think about religion has, I mean, radically shifted from this search for the one true faith, at the same time, I feel so much sympathy with the plight of religion collectively.
I want to know, as you transcended Mormonism, because as you moved past that, what did you mourn? What parts hurt?
Oh, a lot hurt.
Because as we've discussed this, you know, you discuss it in such a level-headed, even-keeled, very pleasant way.
Well, that's because, you know, I keep the scream crying for when I'm in my car. Yeah. I think that I said this to my roommate, actually, that I think that one of the greatest tragedies is a true believing Mormon hearing from a former true believing Mormon that they don't believe anymore. And when I say one of the greatest tragedies, I mean just in this, I mean almost this classic Greek sense of tragedy, where from the perspective of a true believing member of the church, when someone comes to them and says that they don't believe anymore, they're in apostasy, they've lost their faith, their eternal soul is in danger of being lost, you know, and abandoned. And so, it is this pain that echoes into their perception of eternity. And I feel that. I feel that from, well-meaning family members and well-meaning friends who love me. And it's because they love me that they have that intense sorrow for me and for, yeah, the journey that I'm on. And that's painful. To have someone who you love feeling that way about you is a painful thing.
You don't want people to mourn you when you're not dead.
And especially when you feel like you're progressing towards something, that you're seeking and that you're finding light, that you're gaining truth, you're gaining understanding about the way that life is on this planet.
What, you don't sound like you feel like you've lost God in this process.
I don't. I have lost you know, that sense of certainty that I had in Mormonism, like that sense of certainty of who I was praying to, if I was praying, that sense of certainty of how that being wanted me to commune with them, that there's, I mean, that's totally blown out of the water now. And so I don't feel like I've lost God per se, but it's definitely a process of almost reinventing my own religion, like reinventing my own way to commune with whatever is that's bigger than myself.
How would you bear your testimony now?
I would say that evolution is true. I would say that love matters. I would say that seeking is the way to access, I would say questions are important. That might sound almost trivial, but to live with questions and to be comfortable that life will always be filled with questions is a really, I feel like it's a really healthy place to be. I would say that for me, that my access to God is most consistently found in silence, in really trying to quiet my internal world and my external environment, is the best, most consistent way that I have in my life right now to feel like there is a transcendent realm that I can contact in some way.
Okay. And what about the church?
What about the church? gosh, it's just, I really do think that as more scholarship is focused on Mormon origins, that the portrait's just going to become really clear about the very human sources of canon and of revelation. And I really think that that's an inevitable place for the world of Mormon scholarship to go. And it'll be interesting to see what types of tensions that creates as a very grounded and rigorous approach to the questions of Mormon history converge on, you know, a consensus about the human narrative that has become the Mormon religion.
You know, I have some fairly outspoken opinions about information control and the future of information control. I think that information control is a beast that will not be available much longer for organizations. You know, the church has done a pretty good job of controlling its narrative for a long time, especially in the 20th century, as it sort of, I want to say there was a point where it maybe became sort of self-aware of its narrative and the need to reshape it. That may be the legacy of Gordon B. Hinckley as much as anything else. Do you think it will be able to continue to control that narrative?
Well, it's really interesting. So if I would say that, I mean, right now, the Mormon PR is so focused on, I can be hip and cool and fresh and funky and I'm a Mormon, you know, and it's like,
I can have dreadlocks and still pass the sacrament.
I'm a Mormon. Yeah. I'm not just trying to take cheap shots, but it just seems so superficial right now. And so to me, it just feels like grasping at straws. And I'm like, oh gosh, like there's no good place where you can go from this. You know?
Is this all we've got left,
yeah,
guys?
Yeah. It's smoke and mirrors. It's, you know, don't ignore the man behind the curtain. It's, let's focus on how interesting we can be and still be Mormon.
Yeah. Any final thoughts?
I would say that my final thoughts are that I don't know where I want to be in the next 3 years in terms of belief and worldview and the way that life makes sense to me. And I'm so excited for that. Like, I'm so excited to see the Michael that emerges over the next 3 years, over the next 10 years, over the next 50 years. Like, what an awesome, exciting life to be in a constant process of discovery and of co-evolution with the universe. I think that's a wonderful way to live.
You know, I think that's a great parting shot. I want to say that as I've started to note the different ways that we express our feelings, one of the most consistent that seems to come out among us disaffected is this sense of adventure, a sense that I feel strongly and that you're evoking, and that the sense that life became an adventure when we sort of move beyond that. And that, I love that. I love that you expressed that.
Follow the data. Live with a big heart. Be good to people. I mean, I think that those are just like the principles that I really want to live by, and I'm excited to see the life that is produced by living them.
All right. This has been an absolutely fascinating discussion. Really appreciate you coming on and sharing your story.
Thanks for the opportunity, Greg.
Wish you the best, and the discussion and comments will continue on the website. We'll see you all next time.
And letting go has not been easy, but I don't need you loving me for who you think I should be. No, I'm standing here at the end of who I once was, not sure yet. I'm feeling beautiful as I make no excuse.